Hello, and welcome to Around and About Chattanooga. I'm Michael Edward Miller.
And I'm Garrett Crow.
One of America's most prominent independent publishing houses is putting out a local author's first book.
Grove Atlantic has published celebrated authors such as Henry Miller, William S. Burroughs, Barry Hanna, Charles Frazier. Now they're adding Jamie Quatro to their roster. Quatro lives on Lookout Mountain, and her debut collection of short stories is called I Want to Show You More.
Reviewers are already buzzing about Quatro. She's been called a brilliant new voice in American fiction and been compared to Flannery O'Connor.
Her work has appeared in prominent literary journals such as Plowshares, The Southern Review, and Oxford American, where she's a contributing editor.
Her short stories are a mesmerizing mix of magic realism and Southern lit. She explores subjects like infidelity, faith healing, family tragedies, and theology. In one story, for example, a woman has an affair, her lover dies, and then his corpse appears in her home. It just stays there, this dead body, kind of like a literal skeleton in her closet, and she and her family mostly ignore the corpse.
Sounds like a Southern Gothic delight.
Definitely, definitely. Her stories, they are really good, and they're set in familiar locations like Lookout Mountain or a Civil War battlefield or the UTC campus. I talked to Quatro in advance of her book launch. Again, it's called I Want to Show You More. It's a collection of short stories. Jamie Quatro, welcome to Around and About.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Who do you think the audience is for this short story collection? For me, just right off the top of my head, it reminds me somewhat of Karen Russell, author of Swamplandia, Vampires in the Lemon Grove. I can see it appealing to people who like Karen Russell's short stories.
Yes, thank you. I would love it if it would appeal to her audience. Not to take away from Karen Russell's audience, but she's obviously wonderful. George Saunders also came out with a new collection called 10th of December. Have you read that yet?
I have not.
He does a lot of that kind of surreal thing, too. I think literary, people who have a taste for literary short fiction would be a good audience, certainly an adult audience.
Kevin Wilson, I think, also.
Oh,
definitely.
I love Kevin. Yeah. Yes, The Family Fang and Tunneling to the Center of the Earth. His first collection is one of my favorites. So, yeah, there are a number of writers who work in that vein.
One of the stories is called Decomposition, A Primer for Promiscuous Housewives. First of all, I want to say I love that title.
Thanks.
And the story itself, it's about a woman who has an affair. One day she comes home. She finds this guy she's been having an affair with. The guy's lying in her bed, and he's dead. And from there, the story does not at all go the way you would expect. Her husband, who also sees the dead man in the bed, has this really unusual reaction. What does her husband do?
He seems to be in denial that it's a real corpse and claims that it's wax and that there is no decomposition process happening until the end of the story.
I'm going to get rid of it, you tell your husband. I'm going to roll it up in a sheet and drag it outside. Leave it, your husband says. I need you to see that it won't decompose. I won't look at it, you say. Look all you want, he says. Christmas comes and goes. The children seem happy with their gifts, but you're not sure. It's hard to listen when they speak. They are loud and clamorous with need. Your husband requires constant reassurance. The body is still on your bed, though you've covered it with a sheet, which sags over the midsection of the body, rising to a peak at the toes. You spray Febreze and keep the bedroom door locked.
And in the story, it just goes on and on for weeks like that. Literally, a corpse lying there in their bed. And then occasionally they like argue about it. Maybe it's real. Maybe it's made of wax. What are you trying to express with a story like that?
first of all, I'd want to say that when I set out to write a story, there really is no intent. T.S. Eliot said, speaking of intention, one only knows that one needs to get something off one's chest. One doesn't know what that is until one has gotten it off. I love how he uses one so many times in that quote. But it's kind of true that you're really just starting with an image, maybe an inkling of an idea, and something emerges as you're drafting. But as the story came out, I think where it started was I was trying to think about the stages of grief.
Yes.
And I had been reading Madame Bovary, and there's a scene at which Flaubert, you know, typically the mid-19th century novel isn't going to look at the corpse.
Yeah.
You know, they're going to kind of gloss over the funeral and move on, Flaubert, with his surgeon father and with his sort of rigorous attention to detail, spends time with Emma Bovary's corpse. And there's a moment at which they take the veil off of her face and they move the head and black fluid comes out.
Yeah.
And that was the seminal point. When I saw that image in Flaubert, I kind of sat back and thought, wow, I don't know anything about human decomposition. What's happening with that? So I began to research, and I quickly came to the conclusion that the stages of decomposition could be a parallel for the five stages of grief.
You live on Lookout Mountain in the town that is spelled Fairyland, but not actually pronounced that way. And you've got some of that in some of the stories, some of the actual roads that are named after Red Riding Hood, Cinderella, things like that. When you've got readers who are not in the Chattanooga area or maybe editors, is that a hard time for them? Are they like, you must be just making this up to be quirky, and you have to say, no, this is a real place that I really live in?
No, you know, what I have found interesting and what I think editors have found interesting is the border aspect of where I live, the fact that they're is one town, Lookout Mountain, but that it's bisected into
right.
two states. And I do think that borders become places of both confluence and division.
Yes.
So Lookout Mountain is one town. So we share things like the Commons Park, and we share the Lookout Mountain Rec League. But there are also certain distinctions between the two sides. For example, the leash laws. You know, on one side, the Tennessee side, there's a leash law. There isn't a leash law on the Georgia side. And so I really did, moving here, want to explore some of that. Well, what's coming together? What do we share, and what are some of the divisions between the two sides? And I think you do see that kind of bifurcation also thematically, perhaps, throughout the book.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to local author Jamie Quatro. Grove Press is publishing her debut collection of short stories called I Want to Show You More. Her stories are often set in this area, and the characters are familiar. Mothers of young children, teenagers with body issues, or a woman who seeks faith healing for her clinically depressed husband. Some of Quatro's stories deal with infidelity, a series of linked stories about a woman who's having a long-distance affair. Other stories by Quatro are about faith and church and faith healing, extremely realistic portrayals of Southern life. And then some stories happen with a dreamlike, wickedly weird logic. In one of these stories called Ladies and Gentlemen of the Pavement, there's a marathon happening at the Chickamauga battlefield, but there's a twist. The runners have to carry statues. They can't run in this marathon unless they agree to lug around statues randomly assigned to them. Some of the statues are beautiful art. Others are grotesque and sexual, like a physical manifestation of emotional baggage.
You can't choose your statue, but you do get to decide how you'll carry it. Some runners, usually beginners, prefer those front-load snugglies left over from when they had babies. The snuggly runners end up holding their statues against their stomachs because of the bounce. They lose their arm pump and look like they're going to be sick the whole race. Besides, who wants to see her statue while she runs? Not me. They say your statue has nothing to do with who you are as a person. But everyone knows it has everything to do with who you are and what you think about. Why else would so many of them be sexual? The ones who get the real art are the granolas who sit around and pluck out their sadnesses on guitars, who drive everyone else outside while they lie on frayed couches and narrate the stories of their bleeding spleens.
What is going on with this story? Did you sit down and say, I want to write a story about some weird world where people who are runners have to literally carry a statue around, literally carry baggage with them?
No. I was reading a lot of Barry Hanna at that time. I don't know how much Barry Hanna you've read, but he has some wild and crazy stories. And I think I wanted to experiment with a voice similar to sort of a Barry Hanna voice. And then often something in the outside world, I'll see an image or something I'm reading will kind of collide with something I'm thinking about in fictionally. And I happened to see a picture online of a marathon. Well, I don't even know if it was a marathon. It was a run in Europe somewhere, and everybody was carrying crucifixes on their backs. And it looked horrifying,
yeah.
You know, to try and run with that. And I just stared at these pictures of these people running with these things on their back. And, you know, obviously the phrase your cross to bear came to mind. So I guess in some ways, maybe the story's about all of us with our crosses to bear and how we're getting to the end of the race with those things strapped to our backs.
On the subject of Southern literature, first of all, do you consider yourself a Southern writer?
That was a question I posed quite early on to one of my mentors, who her name's Jill McCorkle.
Oh, yes.
Great Southern writer. I was working with her at Bennington and, of course, writing stories set in the South because we'd moved here. And I think when you move to a place, you have a fresh view of the surroundings, and maybe you see things that people who've been here their entire lives have grown used to seeing, or you know, they're inured to it because they've seen it for so long. So I'd write these stories and send them to her, and at one point I said, Jill, you know, I'm from Arizona. Do I have a right to be writing about the South? You know, is this allowed? And she looked at me and she said, Jamie, absolutely. You have every right to write about it.
We will not chase you out with pitchforks.
Yes. I think there's an aspect, too, that when you raise children in a place, and especially when you move here when they're very young, as we did, and your children, they will always consider themselves Southerners.
Yes.
They will never remember, especially the youngest two.
Oh, yeah.
Will never remember another home. And so you do kind of develop this dual, I'm from the West, but my children are Southerners, and I'm raising them. And does that create conflict? Does that create any tension? Or are there differences in the way that they're growing up than I grew up? And those are interesting questions to me that I like to explore in my fiction.
You're writing about characters who are similar to you, characters who live on Lookout Mountain, characters who have children, characters who are in this Chattanooga area. I imagine something people have got to ask you all the time is, since the characters are so similar to you, how much is this actually based on your life, particularly when you're writing about a subject like infidelity?
Well, first of all, I do think it's a temptation when you read stories that are written in the first person in particular to assume that the writer's voice is the one, you know, the writer behind that first person voice is actually telling the story about him or herself. And that's just not the case. There really is a translation that happens between life and fiction.
Yes.
And I was thinking of perhaps an interviewer asking, you know, is it Brad Pitt that played Meet Joe Black?
Oh, yeah, Brad Pitt.
The Devil.
Yes, Brad Pitt.
And asking Brad Pitt, you know, after he played it, so, you know, were you ever really the devil? You know? So there really is. I think people, fiction writers, understand this, that when you're writing fiction, you are divorcing, you're drawing from your life in certain details because they're recognizable, doesn't necessarily mean that everything within the story is true. As far as the infidelity stories, I really was interested in exploring sort of what constitutes infidelity in this modern society when you have all of these digital options that in yesteryear you didn't have. You know,
yeah,
you just
and
go
that's,
to a...
that's one of the things that's very prevalent in your book is it's not just somebody having an affair. It's somebody having an affair in the way that can only really work in the cyberspace era because you've got a woman who's texting, she's emailing, it's phone calls. There's very little physical contact of any kind between her and the man she's having an affair with. Why did you decide to take that specific approach to extramarital affairs?
Mm-hmm. I think it's a proliferating issue kind of in today's world, as you point out, with the rise of digital technology. It's a very interesting question. What constitutes infidelity?
Yeah.
I think that you would get different answers based on who you asked in society. Some people would probably say, no, if you're not touching them physically at all,
then it doesn't matter.
How could that be an affair? And it doesn't matter, and it's safe, and nobody's hurt. And other people might say, you know, it's not that simple. And it's a constantly changing area of technology. There's even a new thing called Snapchat. Have you heard of Snapchat?
I have not heard of Snapchat.
I know of this because I have teenagers. It's a 7 minute, you take a picture and send it to someone, a 7 second look, and then it's gone forever.
Oh, wow.
So you
I can see the potential for abuse.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So I think I did really want to raise the question, well, speaking of collision and division, you know, what is the line? You know, what is the line between faithfulness and unfaithfulness? And is there a line, and how close do you get? I think it's a very interesting question given the rise in the technological world of all these different ways you can enact infidelity.
That's Jamie Quattro. She's an author who lives on Lookout Mountain. Her work has appeared in prominent literary journals such as Plowshares, The Southern Review, and Oxford American, where she's a contributing editor. Grove Press is releasing I Want to Show You More, her debut collection of short stories. She'll have a book launch at the Hamilton Place Barnes & Noble on March 2nd. After that, Grove Press is sending her on a nationwide book tour. Here's the rest of my interview. Another recurring theme in the book of short stories is the idea of church. You've got a teenager at a kind of a church camp. You've got a Christian school party, things like that. Mm-hmm. But your portraits of Christians, of Southerners, of churches, it's not this stereotypical, over-the-top televangelist kind of thing that you often see in movies or TV. It's a much more nuanced, realistic look at what Southerners are really like in church. Is this something you're consciously doing, trying to break out of the stereotypes that pervade popular media?
It has always bothered me that, particularly in literary fiction, you'll often see specifically Protestant Christians as caricatures. Either that or they're just sort of poor, deluded saps. And that has not been my experience. That has not been my experience in the South. Flannery O'Connor said something very helpful when it comes to religion in fiction. She said that she reads a lot of theology because it makes her a bolder writer. And so I have a strong interest in reading a lot of theology. I do find that it sort of elevates the mind and makes me think about things in ways that perhaps I wouldn't think about within the characters' lives. She also said that the image of the South is so powerful that it must be wrestled with until we extract a blessing from it. And so I also feel that it's important to, if you're going to engage with religious questions, that you show a wrestling, because that's authentic and that's real. It you know, this sort of pat, I have all the answers and this is the way it is and we've got it figured out, hallelujah, that just isn't real.
You studied writing at Swanee, at the College of William and Mary, among other places. What do you think are some of the most important lessons that you learned in studying writing fiction?
One of the most important lessons, I'd say, is trust your reader.
Okay.
There really does come a point when you're drafting that you become so close to your material that you have to back away from it and have those one or two or three really close readers that can say, here's what's working, here's what's not working. And being in graduate programs, especially the MFA program at Bennington College, I was able to develop those kind of relationships.
Tell me a little bit about the event that you've got coming up at Hamilton Place on March 2nd.
March 2nd, Saturday, 2 to 4, there'll be a reading. I'll stand up and read a little bit, very short, one of the pieces, and answer questions briefly, and then sign books. And I am told that Starbucks is creating a signature drink for the event.
Oh, wow. That's pretty amazing.
There's a reason to come.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
That was an interview with Jamie Quattro. I talked to her in advance of her book launch in early March 2013. Her debut collection of short stories is called I Want to Show You More. It's published by Grove Atlantic. You can find it at Barnes & Noble, Amazon.com, and pretty much anywhere else you buy books. For WUTC, I'm Michael Edward Miller.